Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist. Join me as I seek out the small incremental changes being applied in other industries that we can learn from and that can be applied in healthcare. Can these changes bring immediate value, but also add up to the big improvements and revolution we need in healthcare? Come along with me to explore the possibilities. My innovative guests from around the globe have used small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot.
And today, I'm delighted to be joined by Craig Joseph. He is the Chief Medical Officer for AVAP. Craig, thanks for joining me today.
Pleasure. Thank you.
As we do on a monthly basis, we take a look at the latest news, what's going on. The last couple of times, we certainly talked about COVID-19, and I think that will be one of the topics. But what I'd like to kick off with, since we're entering not just the week of nurses, but actually the month, I believe, of nurses and nurses appreciation, and we've certainly seen a lot of that. Talk a little bit about the nurses' contribution to healthcare and the healthcare system, and maybe a little bit about how we support them, both in a clinical fashion, but also from a technology perspective, because my experience has been they've always been the forgotten son in the experience. They got nothing in terms of technology. They didn't get speech recognition technology until fairly recently, and that seemed like an obvious thing in terms of note-taking and so forth. Tell us a little bit about your experiences.
Yeah, well, nurses are often, as you say, the unsung heroes, although I hope nowadays that that's less often the case. I think more and more people are understanding the key role that nurses play both in the inpatient realm and in the ambulatory or office-based realm. Certainly, when I was practicing primary care pediatrics, I had nurses in my office who, for sick kids, a good chunk of the time before I even went in to see the patient after they had been roomed by the nurse had already diagnosed, I'm using that in air quotes, but had already figured out probably what was wrong with the patient and had written the question, had asked questions in a directive way so as to get to the problem, and often actually gave the patient a handout or left it for me to give to the patient before I even walked into the room. So nurses, experienced nurses, can do a lot of what physicians do, and what we do from the physician side is impossible without them. I recall my wife, after she delivered the first baby, or at least my first baby, said, I don't understand. The nurse was with me for like 5 hours, and then the OB walks in, and 5 minutes later, he seems to pull out the baby, and then 10 minutes after that, he's gone, and then the nurse is with me again. Like, she did all the work, and then the doctor gets all the credit.
It's just like barbecuing, yeah. Right?
Or maybe it's like painting. It's all in the preparation, really. The actual painting is pretty easy after it's all been prepped and draped and all of that. But nurses. To your point about technology, you're absolutely right. In the olden days, by that I mean 10 years ago, nurses really were left out of the electronic health record. They were an afterthought, and physicians and everyone else really involved in healthcare have really come to the conclusion that's right in front of our faces the whole time that if you slow down the nurses, you've slowed down everyone. And so nurses are now getting hopefully a lot more technology, especially in terms of handheld devices. So lots of things, they don't have to type in vital signs anymore. Now we can really take those off the wall if there's a monitor. There's barcode med administration on the inpatient side, so that adds safety and efficiency to the process. So there are lots of things that nurses are getting and already have that make their job easier. And again, let me emphasize that you're helping the nurses, but even more importantly, you're making the entire process safer and more efficient, and that helps the patient and the physician and the therapist and everyone else involved.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you say that. And I think, certainly my experience, I mean, that I can't keep track of all of the nurses and support clinical staff. I mean, one of the things I would say about this is that it's an extended team. It was everything from what we called ward clerks in our day. Those were the folks that did the administrative, pulled notes and so forth. But, you know, the number of nurses that saved my bacon certainly and taught me so much. And I think I always refer to this because it struck me so much. I don't know that it's still in there, but I actually have the copy from the Oxford Handbook of Clinical Medicine. It was a small portable tome that we carried in our pockets that gave us a guidance. And there was a page in there that talked about nasogastric tubes and what they were and when to use them. And then there were instructions, and the instructions essentially said how to pass a nasogastric tube. Nurses are the experts and will ask you, who may never have passed one before, to do so only when they encountered difficulties. So it said, proceed as follows. One, don a plastic apron. Two, observe the nurse having one more attempt. This will give you a rough idea of how it's done. She may even succeed. Three, tell the patient what you're going to do, and then proceeds on. And that, for me, essentially encompassed a lot of the experiences. It was extraordinary how skilled and you know, how much they did, and you know, such a fantastic sort of support infrastructure. And in particular now in the COVID-19 experience, they're right there. They're, you know, embedded in this whole process, I think, you know, doing all of the sort of work, the support work, obviously, you know, with the team. And, you know, my sort of gratitude, as everybody else does, and like you, I think hopefully people are not going to forget this, because it feels like they do sometimes. I know we, you know, they're the most trusted profession and so forth, but at the same time, clapping and so forth is not what they need. What they need is a fair wage and, you know, appropriate treatment. And by the way, appropriate PPE, I would say.
Oh, agreed. Agreed. You reminded me of a story. I'll just quickly tell that I was on an airplane once, and there was a call for a doctor, which is makes most of us terrified. And here I was, a pediatrician who wasn't practicing at this point, but I had practiced for a good amount of time. And it turned out an elderly woman felt faint. She didn't faint, but she felt like she was going to. And they had laid her in the aisle, which is very narrow, as one can imagine, and put her legs up, or so that, you know, there were some pillows under her feet. So, and this call for physicians got me, a pediatrician who at the time was working for a software company, got an an OB-GYN who was curiously working for another software company, an ophthalmologist, and I think a radiologist. A lot of doctors. Wow. Anyway, we were all looking at each other about what we should do, because none of us really knew what to do. And we came up with the brilliant idea of continuing to keep the patient laying flat and checking her blood pressure. And it turned out she was fine, and no interventions needed to happen. And as we were kind of deciding we were going to put her back in her seat and go back and sit down, the flight attendant came and made sure we were all okay, and then said, I'm so glad you doctors were here. It's kind of funny. She said, someone came from the back and said she was an emergency room nurse, but we told her, no, you're not needed because we have doctors here. And the listening audience can't see that you're cracking up right now, as are most physicians, because during an emergency, I'm not sure if I had to choose between an ER nurse and even an ER doctor, I'm not sure that I wouldn't choose the ER nurse if I'm on a plane. Just because they are the ones who, you know, take care of all of the bad things that happen unexpectedly you know, can just deal with anything that's thrown at them. And that's really not true of certainly most physicians. It's not true of often some of a large percentage of nurses who deal in a much more controlled environment. Unlike the ER, where you never know what's walking in there. So we all instantly started laughing and told the flight attendant, if that ever happened again, to please, for the love of God, bring the ER nurse up, and we will all help her in whatever she needs from us. And that's the relationship most doctors at least have with nurses. Once they figure out who actually runs a hospital or an office, the doctor's name might be on the door, but that place is the soul of that place are the nurses and the techs.
Fantastic. I've had a number of experiences like that, and I think I would sort of leave it with the commentary that you know, we applaud our clinical colleagues, all of them, but especially in this month and especially in this pandemic, our nursing colleagues, with the deepest of gratitude, who are on the front line of all of this and do so much to support their patients and their associated clinical colleagues. So thank you to all of you for what you do.
Bravo.
So back to COVID-19, just to give people a quick update and maybe just worth sort of highlighting, I think one of the things that we're hearing is repeated testing. That's, you know, certainly one of the drivers that we see or have been suggested as one of the ways of opening up the economy. And my experience with that, when I served on the telephone answering service for the healthcare system in my state, was probably 40% of the calls were people that we would establish, or at least I personally would establish pretty high suspicion of having COVID-19, had a high fever and associated symptoms, exposure and so forth. And the guidance or the recommendation is go get tested. But what I discovered with at least 40% of these people was they didn't have insurance. And whilst normally we say that this test is free, it wasn't. And we were instructed to make sure that we explained this because you still had to get a physician order. And well, thankfully, there were some stand-up sites that had physicians there or some clinical provider who would provide the order, but it was going to cost you. And that wasn't free. That wasn't covered. It ranged from, I believe, about $50, $100 to about $150. And then there was also an associated cost with the test. So not for the test, but actually executing the test. Maybe it was for the associated bag that was, I don't know what the charge was for, but it wasn't free. And in all cases, if I was to suggest what the outcome would be for that individual, they would get off the phone and they would not get tested because they didn't have insurance and couldn't afford to pay for that. And in light of that, and the 26 odd million people that just lost health insurance and their income from jobs, my question is, how in the hell are we going to test everybody and get people back to work?
Well, not that way. See how smart I am? I prefer not to tell you how to answer the problem, but that's I can tell you what the answer is not. I mean, I think ultimately we have to get to a place where tests are free, really free, meaning there's no charge whatsoever, and do not require a physician's order. That's just the stumbling block. We have a small number of physicians relative to the number of patients we're supposed to be testing. Talking about 1% of the numbers I keep hearing, 1-2% of the United States should be tested every month or something along those lines, some just crazy high number. And so what you want is a big proportion of people. You want people who when they talk to a physician like you, are told, yeah, you probably got it based on these signs and symptoms. You should go get tested. But we also want the worried well, people who think they might have it, but don't. So we can start to get some sense of what's going on. And then a third group of people that need to be tested are people who don't want to be tested. And I don't mean that, you know, we should hold them down and stick a Q-tip up their nose, but, you know, random people who are just going about their day, whatever that means.
We need people first, folks.
Don't leave your house or we might stick a Q-tip up your nose. It's funny, but it's, you know, we need to know what percentage of people who are walking around in the United States are going to test positive. And the only way to do that is to test those three groups, right? People who absolutely meet the criteria, people who probably don't meet the criteria but are really worried, so that for peace of mind they should know. And then that third group is the by far the largest group, which is are people who are just randomly selected. And maybe that just means that, hey, you're feeling fine, but you went to the store and there's someone out there asking you if you would like a test, right? Then you're going to start to get those numbers up, and then you're going to start to say, wow, you know, 20% or 10% or 2% or whatever that number is of people who just went to the store, who are feeling fine, are positive. And that helps our decision makers and leaders figure out, exactly what's the best way of approaching this. So it's insane to think that right now, today, you need a physician's order for this test. You know, you shouldn't need a physician's order.
So for those of you joining, yeah. I'm Dr. Nick, the incrementalist, and today I'm talking to Craig Joseph, and we were just discussing the COVID-19 testing challenges, and certainly Craig's position in terms of making sure that we get everybody tested. I think I'm certainly in favor of that. I, you know, not to make too much light of it, but I think incredibly important to get everybody, because you don't get the denominator if you don't get the people that don't think they have it. And one of the clear messages in all of this is there are so many. I don't know if you saw the results of that aircraft carrier. Ultimately, of the people that had a positive test, fully 60% asymptomatic. 60% of people are walking around with this virus. So the idea that you're suggesting that, you know, we need to capture these people that don't want to be, I think is important. So moving on from that, one of the things that I certainly saw, and, you know, there was an uptick in interest, was around immunity. So you've had COVID-19 and expect, well, that's great, I'm not going to get it again. And there seemed to be a release of information from the WHO that was picked up by the media that said, maybe not. Craig, tell us what you think.
The answer is no one knows, right? That seems to be what the answer is. And I would just, as many of us probably should do, is quote Tony Fauci, who said, who knows exponentially more than me about this. He said, well, we certainly don't know, because this is a novel coronavirus. It's new. It's never been seen before. So we don't really have any information about how immunity works. However, it's a coronavirus. So one would imagine, one could hypothesize that it is going to react and work like other coronaviruses, meaning that our reaction, our immunity would be similar. We probably will have someone who's tested positive will probably make antibodies, and those antibodies will probably be protective to some extent for some amount of time. And if you just parse what I just said, I told you I don't know, except to say, you know, it's highly likely that you will be protected to some extent for some amount of time. Now, some percent might be, yeah, you know, the disease is on average 20% less severe, or 50% less severe, or 90% less severe. Those are very big changes, right? And for how long? Maybe it's a month, maybe it's 6 months, maybe it's 12 months. I think what I've heard is, you know, 6 to 9 months seems to be a guess. That's a reasonable guess. So I think that's a good place to start, to think that, okay, much like a common cold and coronavirus, other coronaviruses are typical causes of a common upper respiratory tract infection. Those are typically, you can get those again. And that's why we get common colds forever, really. Those are possible to get even after you've had them before, but probably you're getting some immunity and some protection as you kind of go along for some amount of time. So if you get sick twice in a row, it's probably not the same virus strain, but you're probably not, if it were, it's probably not going to be as severe the second time around. But maybe this only lasts a year, you know, and if we're going to keep seeing this every year until we get some kind of medication or other protection against it, vaccine possibly, you know, it's going to come back. But I think anyone that tells you that they know is just foolish or lying.
Right. So I think what I got from that was what you heard Craig say is, I agree with the WHO, we don't know, which was what their piece stated. But then you logically extended it with the best insights that we have from the likes of Tony Fauci, who has said, this is our best understanding based on data that says this is the same, or it's a similar kind of virus. So no, you're not going to get it again as such. There is some hope for some level of immunity that we don't understand. So I agree with that. We got a few minutes left. I wanted to talk about the USMLE, kind of a hot topic, certainly in and around my circles, because what they did in the recent past was they decided, first of all, they started canceling some of the test dates. And these are extraordinarily important. You know this from your time of studying this, that this determines your future based on how you do. So they've placed more importance on it as a result of grading. It was never supposed to be originally. And it is a dedicated time of study where you learn all of the basic sciences and have to relearn it for, wait for it, seven hours of actual time, 8 hours with breaks of testing, and huge stress related, but they've canceled it for over 50%. And for the 50% that still have their test dates, they're going to proceed as normal with all the plans. But for everybody else, it looks like they're going to be doing it in their third year and you can't do that at the same time as third year. How do you think you would have felt if that had been you as a medical student? If you, I'm assuming you were completely casual and no stress, no nothing.
Yeah, like most. So, USMLE, the United States Medical Licensing Exam, has several parts, and the part one is the part you're referring to is generally taken after between your second year and third year of medical school. And remember, in the United States, medical school is 4 years, and traditionally, it's changed, but traditionally, the first 2 years was you studied basic science. You studied anatomy, physiology, biochemistry, pathology. You studied it from textbooks and sitting in lecture halls, and really had very little patient contact. And third year is when you really started to apply that to real patients. And you're absolutely right. I remember vividly studying for the part one of USMLE, and we had about 30, maybe 3.5 weeks off of school to study for this test. And I remember another fellow student of mine, we came up with a schedule where we said this is where we're going to be, and just spent just a significant amount of time memorizing these facts, which sadly but predictably we forgot by July 1.
So it must have been
So
important then.
I think that hopefully we're learning that a lot of these things are not important, right? And some of them are. The ones that are important are remembered by the physicians who need them. But for most of us, we just need to know that they're there and to try to understand them at a higher level. But we really don't need to get down to the molecular level to understand some of these illnesses. And so, yeah, the idea of having those 3.5 weeks and then having that test postponed until a date unknown, and then
Unknown.
expected to go taking it without getting that 3.5 weeks back of time to study, just has got to be heart-wrenching for the medical students that are put through this. And
And I think the
I
other
don't,
thing that
yeah.
really troubles me about this is that half of the medical students are proceeding as normal and will be compared to the other half that are living essentially what is already a nightmare because their whole study routine and everything has been upset, upended. But now they're adding this with all of the uncertainty. How on earth can you? So 50% are already starting way back behind the line, which just doesn't seem fair if this is the way that you grade everybody and determine what their future is going to be in terms of the match program.
Yeah, and it's not. I feel it's kind of like the ACT or SAT for high school students, right? It's not the end all be all, but if everything else is equal, that's what these residency programs are going to look at. And so it's really unfortunate and hard to imagine, how it's going to. It's certainly not fair. I guess that's what I'm saying. I was going to say it's hard to imagine how it's fair. It's not. And these two groups are not given the same opportunity to succeed, and hopefully the residency programs will be taking that into account.
So yeah, that would be important, but I think my big pitch on this would be fix the problem, don't create the problem. And the problem was created by canceling them because they say they can't do it with enough space around people and 50% have gone. Well, replace that with 50% in another testing center. And I know all the medical schools, well, not all, but at least some of them are saying, we're willing to run these tests. We've got the space. They have proctored these exams before. They have the same vested interest in an appropriate outcome. Stand that up. It just seems like a reasonable approach and put everything back on track and put them into those programs and remove that additional burden. It just seems the most appropriate course of action. But that's
Absolutely
me.
does. Yep.
Anyway, as usual, we have run out of time. Great discussion. Nurses, COVID-19, and USMLE in step one. Craig, as always, it's a great pleasure chatting with you. Thank you for catching up with me.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining me today. Do you have any better ideas, or have you found a small incremental change that's brought about a big improvement in your world? Let's continue the conversation on our hashtag, TheIncrementalist, or share with me at DrNick1 on Twitter. You can find more information about the show on our program page at healthcarenowradio.com. And tune in next time to hear my discussions with leaders and innovators from around the globe who've revolutionized their space by using small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist, and I'm starting a revolution through evolution.